I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views.
Parallax is you observe an object, you see a change, but that change is not really a change in the object, but just a change in how you relate to the object in your perspective of the object.
Welcome to the testing room of the Parallax Corporation's Division of Human Engineering.
Now please cross the chair. And you will sit down. Make yourself comfortable. And be sure to place each one of your hands on the box on either side of the chair. Making sure that each one of your fingers is on one of the white rectangles. Just sit back. Nothing is required of you except to observe the materials that are presented to you. Be sure to keep your fingers on the box at all times. Alright? Hope you find the test a pleasant experience.
On this edition of Parallax Views, while concerns about the global pandemic known as the coronavirus continue to mount in the United States, many folks are being hit by symptoms of another entirely different condition sweeping the nation, namely election fever. The surprise comeback of former Vice President Joe Biden in the Democratic Party primaries proved to be a dark day for progressive activists, specifically supporters of Bernie Sanders. As we race toward the general election in November that will pit the Democratic nominee against sitting President Donald Trump, the heat has been turned up a notch on the Democratic Party primary race. Pete Buttigieg, Amy Klobuchar, Michael Bloomberg, and now Elizabeth Warren have all dropped out of the running, leaving us with a matchup between the centrist moderate Joe Biden and the progressive Bernie Sanders. Joining us later on this edition of the program to discuss the aftermath of Super Tuesday and where the progressive movement and the left need to go from here is Eric Dreitzer of Counterpunch Radio. But first,
an important win for Vice President Al Gore. NBC News projects that he wins the 25 electoral votes in the state of Florida. What the networks giveth, the networks taketh away. NBC News is now taking Florida out of Vice President Gore's column and putting it back in the too close to call column. But we won't know about Florida until at least midnight, between midnight and 1 a.m. At any rate, it is a much more closely contested race in Florida. Florida, in the final analysis, the home state of Governor Jeb Bush. It's going to be a much happier Thanksgiving for the Bush family. George Walker Bush, the 43rd president of the United States.
I think that the Bushes are intentionally trying to rig this election.
It's a lot of whining and complaining about the outcome of an election that didn't go their way.
The chads that are being dimpled during the counting process that have been objected to and are now being counted are tainted ballots.
There are dimpled ballots, there are ballots with creases, there are ballots with lipstick on them, there are ballots with handwriting on them.
It's not good for the country that it lingers on this way.
This is a time to respect every voter and every vote.
Bush won twice! Bush won twice!
These people are as stupid as the day is long. Let us see the ballots. Let us see the ballots. Let us in. Let us in.
Count every vote.
Yet another recount.
Celebration for Palm Beach County Canvassing Board members came after a marathon weekend recount, but at 7:15 p.m., it was 2 hours and 15 minutes too late. They watched minutes later as Secretary of State Katherine Harris excluded not only the last 1,000 ballots, but the results of the partial recount provided by the 5 p.m. deadline.
You find ballots that can clearly have a discernible intent of the voter found from them, and yet they're not counted.
I think America ought to be comforted to know that the highest court of our land is going to make sure that the outcome of this election is a fair outcome.
The U.S. Supreme Court's 5-4 decision in favor of George Bush apparently spelling the end to Al Gore's chance for the presidency.
What you just heard were news clips pertaining to the controversies surrounding the 2000 presidential election, which pitted Republican George W. Bush against Democrat Al Gore, who, by the way, was fresh off a run as vice president under Bill Clinton. For a brief period, it appeared to many, including the news media, that Gore would win the election. However, reporting on Gore's victory in Florida, where George W.'s brother, Jeb Bush, was serving as governor, suddenly proved incorrect at the 11th hour. Controversy arose when it was found that Votomatic machine-driven punch card ballots appeared to have left a sizable number of voters unaccounted for. Republicans claimed that this was because said voters were not sophisticated enough to use the Votomatic machines properly. Meanwhile, Democrats demanded recounts. The debacle eventually went all the way to the Supreme Court when it was decided that Bush would be declared the winner of the presidential race. Nonetheless, public figures ranging from progressive radio host Tom Hartman to famed attorney Vincent Bugliosi would go on to dissect the controversies and challenge Bush's victory after the fact. In 2018, noted true crime author and investigative journalist Stephen Singular sought to tell the story of his investigation into the matter by way of his book, Stolen Future: The Untold Story of the 2000 Election. Singular was knee-deep in the story as it was happening, but only recently, thanks in large part to the media outlet Who, What, Why, has he been able to tell the tale. And I must say, it's a tale straight out of a crime noir thriller. Regardless of your take on the 2000 presidential election, Stephen Singular's Stolen Future raises troubling questions about the state of election integrity in the United States of America. Whether one believes the result of the 2000 presidential election was due to malfeasance or the potential incompetence of the companies behind the Votomatic machines that haunted said election, Singular's reporting, in my view, should make us all consider the age-old question of whether or not money belongs in politics. Should something as important as a presidential election be left in the hands of the private interests who create our voting machines? With that in mind, I'm very proud to present a conversation I recorded with Stephen Singular on, believe it or not, Super Tuesday 2020. I think it's a fascinating and informative discussion. And with that being said, let's get right to the conversation with Stephen Singular, author of Stolen Future, The Untold Story of the 2000 Election. Welcome to Parallax Views. The great investigative journalist and New York Times best-selling author, Stephen Singular. How are you doing today?
Good. I'm doing good. Thank you for having me on your program.
So, Stephen, you've written a number of books that I'm very, very fond of in one way or another, specifically Talked to Death, about the assassination of Alan Berg, a Jewish radio host, by a neo-Nazi group called The Order. And since then, you've kept writing about topics ranging from the BTK killer to the election of 2000. And that's in your new book, your latest book, I believe, Stolen Future, out now from Who, What, Why. Before we get into that book, maybe you could tell my listeners a little bit about your career as an investigative journalist. Just a little background.
A little background from me. Okay. I grew up in rural Kansas. I was a freelance writer in New York City for most of the 1970s, and I moved to Denver in September of 1981. And the reason that's significant is that I've always been kind of a radio junkie. I grew up in a very small town, and radio was sort of the connection to the outside world. So when I moved to Denver, I, you know, wanted to check out the radio dial, and one of the first things I heard was a man named Alan Berg on the radio, whom you just alluded to, and he was talking about racism and anti-Semitism and wanting people to call in and talk about that. And I had not written a book at that point. I'd done a lot of freelance writing for magazines, et cetera, but he would, aggravate and beyond aggravate a lot of people with some of what he did on the radio, even though it was quite serious. And 3 years later, well, about a year later, I wrote about him for the Denver Post Sunday Magazine, and then he was killed about a year after that, assassinated in his driveway in June of 1984. And that, I wasn't really necessarily planning on ever writing about crime, but this was such a vivid story. I was right in my backyard, and it led to my first book, and it led me into really writing about crime. And I've subsequently written a dozen other books about high-profile crimes, ranging from the JonBenet Ramsey case, also here in Colorado, to the polygamist Warren Jeffs, the BTK serial killer, the O.J. Simpson case, and a number of other books. So it was really the doorway into not only writing about true crime, but sort of tracking in some ways the whole racist kind of underbelly of America. I mean, that elements of this would resurface in the Simpson case. It would obviously resurface in the Oklahoma City bombing case of 1995. And it even, in some ways, touches on the Stolen Future book, which we're going to talk about.
I just wanted to add, I would even say it relates to your work on the BTK killer, because when we look at the BTK killer, he actually seems to have almost a Christian evangelical mindset and a very authoritarian mindset. And you mentioned O.J. Simpson. Some of your work on Mark Furman is really indispensable, and we can see this sort of far-right connections and mindsets in a lot of your work.
Well, and there's sort of a progression to it that it started out, when you look at the Berg case, it was really nine guys who called themselves The Order getting together in the woods in 1983 and saying, let's have a white power revolution and overthrow the United States government and get rid of all the minorities and other people on our enemies list. And so, I mean, that's a very obscure, small group. I mean, you take it into the Simpson case and a lot of other cases around the country since then, and you're talking about police departments exercising forms of racism. So, I mean, it sort of moved from the fringes, you know, more into the mainstream. I mean, if you get into the last 3 or 4 years, people will argue that you've had, you know, white nationalists working in the federal government, maybe even in the White House. So there's this thread that sort of has grown from a very obscure small group to much more visible group and still creating havoc.
And to dive into Stolen Future, I want to start with the way you introduce the book. You talk about your 50th birthday and a very interesting experience you had under the heading of The Ghost of MAGA Future. Could you talk a little bit about that experience and why you felt like it was necessary to share that at the beginning of the book?
Well, I think back to that. That was actually November of 2000, when I would have been turning 50, and I was having dinner through a business situation with a very, very prominent business person, highly successful and somewhat well-connected to Washington and other places. And so when the election sort of started to go sideways, even that night, November 7th, 2000, I remember this person just saying to me in this very threatening way, you know, basically this will not stand, you know, we're going to win this election, meaning the Republicans, and anybody who gets in our way will basically be crushed. And you know, with the essentially like that old line, that old song, the future belongs to us. And I was just very struck by the force of it. He said something to the effect of, you know, if you're not with us, you're against us. And it really struck me hard at the time, but I really didn't, you know, think about how that was going to resonate into the future. And so if you look at what is going to happen in the next couple of years, especially in the context of that election, it just is something that rolled out in a powerful emotional way for me, and also in the things that would affect the country. And you realize, I mean, here you're talking to somebody Ivy League educated, very successful, incredible amounts of money and influence, and they're just terrified of basically of what the United States is becoming. I mean, it's not fair to connect it to the neo-Nazis that we're talking about 15 years earlier when I was writing about Alan Berg's death, but some of the same ideas are present. It's like, well, this basically, I don't like the present in the United States. I don't like what it's becoming. And that's, again, that's a thread running through all of this. And so that kind of became the starting point for this whole adventure into the 2000 election.
And I was going to state, we even see a little bit of that mindset with Donald Trump in the 2016 election, where he basically said, if I don't win the election, you know, it was a deep state coup. He wouldn't accept loss, essentially, to Hillary Clinton. So there is this sort of mindset amongst a lot of the GOP that people like Al Gore, people like Hillary Clinton, the Democrats in general, represent an existential threat.
Right. It's no longer the loyal opposition. You know, the old phrase that used to be used in politics, where the Democrats and Republicans would, you know, quarrel on the floor of Congress and then go out and have dinner together. It was much more divisive and contentious than that. Exactly what you're saying. I mean, what serves the larger purpose? You know, are we all Americans in this together, or can it be nothing but us versus them, and we have to win?
Now, for my listeners, there's been a lot of talk about election integrity since the 2016 election. Also, even with the Iowa caucus, regardless of what one thinks of it, the issues with the app used by a private company have really sort of bothered people. But we can really trace a lot of this back to November 7th, 2000, when CBS and Peter Jennings were reporting that Al Gore would win the presidential election against George Bush. But then something happened. For my younger listeners that may be unfamiliar with the 2000 election, what happened on November 7th, 2000?
Well, the networks in particular, and it will be true today, this is obviously Super Tuesday of 2020 and all these elections are going on across the country. And what will happen is that the networks will use polling, and the polls will tell them well in advance, before all the votes have been counted, you know, who's going to win, because they can extrapolate from numbers from voting in particular places to come to that conclusion. It's a tried and true formula. It had worked very well before 2000, and about 10:30, I believe, on the East Coast, Peter Jennings, who was the anchor for ABC Television, came on and very confidently announced that Al Gore would be the next, I think, 43rd, if my numbers are right, president of the United States. I mean, that is a big deal. It was a closely fought contest against Gore and George W. Bush, and networks do not make projections like this without knowing what they're doing. I mean, if you watch what literally will go on today, you will see that. And so, you know, there was a sigh of relief among the Democrats and people who lean in that direction, saying, you know, not only, as I recall, I mean, Clinton had been in office for 8 years, and now Gore was following up as a Democratic president as Clinton's vice president. I think it was the first time since 1932 that had happened. I may be wrong about that, but it had been decades before you'd had back-to-back Democratic administrations. And of course, that just has all kinds of implications about what the future is going to look like, Gore being a environmentalist, et cetera. And the man that I had dinner with the night of the election, who was anything but an environmentalist, called Gore a name that I can't even begin to repeat on your program. I mean, it was that nasty against him. So Gore represented a lot of progressive ideas. About 30 minutes later, Peter Jennings comes back on looking flustered and embarrassed and said, I think maybe I called this thing too early. You know, it appears that something is happening that we don't quite understand, and frankly, something that was happening that it really had never happened before. And he said, this is too close to call. We withdraw our projections, and we don't know what's happening or why it's happening or what's going to happen next. About 4 hours later or so, Fox News Channel, which we all know is right leaning and which had someone working for it in the election numbers department that was a relative of the Bush family, came on and said, Fox came on and said, George Bush is the winner. So now you have real chaos starting to unfold. So to play this out a little bit, there's a lot of history involved here, but for those who are younger may not know the whole story, this threw everything into chaos. And for the next, I believe, about 5-6 weeks, nobody knew who won the election. And on December 12th, after an incredible amount of legal wrangling, it was kicked up to the Supreme Court. Effectively a strategy by the Republican Party that was pretty much in place when this started. The Republican Party, by the way, which has always touted states' rights, but they didn't want the state of Florida to decide this election. They wanted the Supreme Court to. They knew that there were 5 people on the Supreme Court who were going to go in their direction, and they were going to win that contest 5-4. So instead of roughly 100 million people deciding who was the next president of the United States, 5 Supreme Court justices did. The Democrats lost. It was a very bitter, bitter fight. Gore eventually conceded after this and gave up. And as you can well imagine, the finger-pointing that went on, who's to blame for this, what happened, just unrolled for about that 6-7 week period that essentially went on from November 7th till the end of the year, when the Bush administration started to pick its cabinet members to be inaugurated on January 20th. So there were countless, countless issues floated out, and that's what's important for people to understand. You know, the Republican point of view was sort of, well, a lot of these problems happened in minority areas, and those people don't really know how to vote, so it's really their fault.
I wanted to comment real quickly. I think the sort of code language that I've heard used is, oh, these voters were uneducated or unsophisticated,
right.
Which to me is racial speak. But
right, the racist undertone, which I alluded to earlier, was right there. You know, where did the problems really occur? Well, while all of this arguing was going on, the Miami Herald did a very in-depth study and said that I think it was in Miami-Dade County or a variety of counties where there were a significant number of minority voters. The votes were likely to be tossed out at a rate of 3-1 compared to the other areas of Florida. Again, to get a little bit technical with the audience, but what happened in the election was that a number of ballots were called overvotes, in which it looked as if you were looking at the paper cards that go through the vote counting machines, that a bunch of the perforations or chads were punched out, meaning that the voter apparently voted for too many people or more than one person. That's called in election terms an overvote. Contrary-wise, on some of the ballots, it was appeared that the voter had voted for nobody, that none of the chads were pushed out, and that, again, the voter simply didn't vote for anyone for president. So you had basically hundreds of thousands of these ballots were in play after the election. And I think about 6.6 million people voted in Florida, and there were several hundred thousand ballots that didn't seem to make any sense. And so that was the heart of the legal battle. The Republicans said any ballot that is like that, you know, should be tossed out on its face. And the Democrats said, if you study these ballots carefully, you can see in some cases the intent of the voter. This gets complicated technically, but we need to count those ballots because those people did vote, and you can determine intent if you go about it seriously enough. And again, for those who weren't around at that time or not paying attention to it, the iconic images that came out of the 2000 election were the officials in Florida studying these paper ballots through magnifying glasses, et cetera, trying to determine the intent of the voter. It looked as if that process had been played out to its fullest extent, and this is what the Miami Herald concluded with a very scientific study, that if it had been allowed to play out, Gore would have won the election. What happened with the legal strategy to get it to the Supreme Court is that it stopped that process. The ballots were not counted, and the White House was effectively handed over to George W. Bush. So that's, you know, the sort of historical little package of all of this. And one of the things that came under great criticism throughout this whole process and ended up with lawsuits, et cetera, were the voting machines. They were called Votomatic, et cetera. I think maybe there were others, but that was the one that I recall most. And people said, well, there's something wrong with the machine. That's number one. Or there's something wrong with the people who are running the machines. Or there's something wrong with all those minority voters in those heavily minority districts in Miami-Dade County or Broward County. So that's where the problem lies. And then the Supreme Court made its ruling, sort of case closed. That's it. And I was, like everyone else, watching this. I live in Colorado, watching from a distance, and wondering, you know, what in the world happened here. There were no answers that came out of it for what was really the single most important question. And this becomes very important, I think, as this whole story unfolds and right up to the present moment. The single most important question was, why were the polls wrong? Not that becomes the prevailing issue. That was not so much focused on during all that legal debate, et cetera. Lawyers don't really necessarily get into the why of things. But for a journalist such as myself, an investigative reporter watching it, that became the real overwhelming, overriding question. So as I was watching all this, I have some contacts in Florida, and I was contacted by somebody who is a mechanical engineer, and he told me a very, very interesting story. And he said that he and his wife had received absentee ballots, and they had decided to vote 2 or 3 weeks before election night and then mail their ballots in. And so they had gone through that whole process. So if you can visualize what I'm saying, you have a punch card, you take a stylus or some sharp object, and you punch through the Chad representing the person you're voting for, Gore Bush, let's say, and then you push it through, and then you send in your ballot.
And Chad stands for card hole accumulated debris, and these are on punch cards.
Right, right. These Chads, these perforations, little squares. I believe there were 312 in the Miami-Dade area, and I believe in Fort Lauderdale and Broward there were 212. Again, this is 20 years ago, so that's what I recall. So he punched out his card, and he laid it aside or did whatever he did, and he went back and he picked it up a little while later, and he noticed that all the Chads had folded back in their holes. So if he had picked up his card and put it in an envelope and sent it off, it would have been an undervote. It would have come across as if he had voted for nobody. He looked at his wife's card. They voted for the same person, and exactly the same thing happened. So he just kind of shrugged and, punched them out again and tore off the little Chad and put it in the mail and sent it off and didn't think too much about it. It didn't occur to him that 3 weeks later, something exactly like this was going to throw the American election system and the next presidency of the United States into total chaos. So he knows I'm a journalist, and he actually contacted me after all the dust had settled in early January of 2001 and said, this weird thing happened, when we were voting absentee. And he said, what's really interesting is that nobody in all of the talk, all of the legal fighting, et cetera, that had gone on there for about 2 months, everybody talked about everything except the cards, the machines, the people, et cetera, the layout of the ballot, all of that. But what about the cards? And he said, I'm a mechanical engineer, and that would be my first question. What caused the cards to do what they did? And was it an entirely random situation that created this, or was it something more than that? And so if you break this down a little bit for people, what actually happened on election night that caused Peter Jennings to come back on the air being flustered and embarrassed is that as the cards have to go through the machines several times to get an accurate count, to make certain that it's certified and all of that. As the cards kept going through the vote counting machines, the totals kept changing. The numbers kept shifting. And so whereas Jennings thought he was on rock solid ground at 10:30, let's say at 11 p.m., he was on very shaky ground. What was happening with those cards as they were going back through the vote counting machines? And this engineer friend said, I'm not a lawyer, I'm a scientist, essentially. That's the question that has intrigued me ever since this began. Was the problem in the cards, not someplace else? So he said, knowing that I'm sort of adventurous fellow, he said, why don't you come down here? Maybe we can get our hands on some cards, and maybe we can examine them and test them and see if we can learn anything that hasn't yet been learned. And the mission wasn't any more definitive than that. And I thought, well, that would be really hard to do. It seemed to me like sitting in Denver with all of this controversy surrounding the situation. But, I'm an investigative reporter. As far as I was concerned, there were no answers to this mystery at all. So I went down there and spent about a week, first part of January 2001, and we got very easily, we went to Broward County's election warehouse where all the cards that had been used in the election were stored, the very center, epicenter of this whole controversy. But they were also virgin cards. They were cards that had not been used, and you obviously couldn't get your hands on the ones that had been voted with, but what about the others? And what we found quickly was that the people who worked there, and again, there were lawsuits flying all over Florida about everything imaginable, and these people had been in the spotlight of the whole thing, and they were being charged with corruption and stupidity and everything else. So, but they were just like us. That was a really interesting part of it. They said nothing like this has happened before, and we don't know what went on, and we don't know why we're the target of everybody, because we didn't do anything any different from last time or the election before. So we got our hands on some stacks of cards and began learning that the company that primarily provided the cards for the three dominant counties.
Really briefly, not to interrupt you, but when you're at the election departments, I believe you talked to John Clouser of the Miami-Dade County Election Department, and he says there's a dirty little secret. Is that what you're referring to prior?
We went to Broward County, and they very willingly gave us some cards. Then we went down to Miami-Dade, and John Clouser was the person there, and they didn't want to give up any cards. I mean, these people were awfully skittish, as you would imagine. But he said, there's a dirty little secret, and the dirty little secret is that the voting companies know virtually ahead of time of an election who's going to vote, where they're going to vote, who they're going to vote for, and they basically have a layout of the whole electoral picture before the cards are ever manufactured. He just offered this up to us. We were asking questions, and so, you know, precinct by precinct, they sort of knew where everything was headed ahead of time. Now, if you go back to what I said, according to the Miami Herald, the majority of the problems occurred where the punch cards were used in places where the minority voting was high. That would be at Miami-Dade, for example, where the minority voting was 10-1 for Al Gore. So if you know ahead of time that that's what's going to happen, that could be a very useful piece of information.
I see. And was there anything else you wanted to add to that? I was going to get into asking you about election systems and software, ES and S. Maybe you could talk a little bit about this company and its background, and then we'll get into your experience touring an ES and S facility.
Right. They're a company that's based in Omaha, Nebraska. They tout themselves, and I'm sure it's all very accurate, as the leading voting company for election system software, voting cards, et cetera, in the United States. They provide tens of millions of cards throughout the United States and around the world for elections, or they did back then in terms of the card part. I think they still tout themselves as the leading voting company in the United States. They had deep ties to the Republican Party. They're a privately owned company, so it's very hard to figure out how they operate. But they had various ties into the Republican Party. Chuck Hagel was connected to the company. He had worked in the Bush 1 White House, and there were other connections between the GOP and this company. So that in itself was interesting, not something I knew ahead of time, that you know, the people who are actually giving us the mechanism by which we vote as Americans, they're not some objective, you know, company floating out in space, but they're tied in politically to our system, in this case, pretty much to one party. So I began to look into that company, and their manufacturing plant is in Edison, Texas, which is right outside of Dallas.
Real briefly, just to give a little bit more background for my listeners, because I found this part very interesting within the book, ES and S can be traced back to a business called Datamark, founded by Bob and Todd Yurosevich, and that has ties to a family known as the Amundsen family, Howard Amundsen. Maybe you could talk a little bit about him, because
right.
some of his ideas seem very similar to the ground you covered in Talk to Death.
Right. The Amundsen family, again, they're the founders, you know, the original iteration of the company that would become ES&S was tied in with that family, and the founder there held extremely right-wing ideas about gay people and minorities and all of this. I mean, I wouldn't say that was neo-Nazi, but that there were parallels. Again, this same theme keeps surfacing, it seems like, in the stories that I've pursued and just in the culture in general.
And he was a Christian Reconstructionist, or associated with Christian Reconstructionism,
right.
which people should look that up.
Yeah.
That movement has advocated for the death penalty for homosexuals. They're a very extreme
right.
movement.
Right. And the order that killed Alan Berg was called Identity Christianity. So, again, they're using that word Christianity pretty much for their own definition.
And I believe that movement was also, they said that slavery was the most beneficent of biblical laws. I mean, this is scary stuff,
yeah.
folks.
Yeah. So the company's roots go back in that direction. So again, very right-wing origin. So what happened was I went to Florida and we got our hands on some cards. And we began to test the cards to just see. We did not have greatly sophisticated equipment. I mean, I'll be honest with you, but my friend was an engineer and he knew how to do certain measurements beyond my abilities. And we started looking at the cards to see if all of the Chads, you know, behaved similarly. In other words, would the Chad that represented George Bush on the card come out more easily or not? Would the one representing Gore come out more harder or not? What about the paper? Was the paper used? Would that make a difference? If the paper is very porous, would that have an effect? How is the paper made? Who made the paper? All of these in-depth questions that nobody was pursuing in the wake of the mangled 2000 election. So he began to feel that there was a lot more to this story than had yet come out. And it had to do potentially with the manufacturing of the cards, how they were made, when they were made, and where they ended up. And so we began an investigation into that. Now, what's important to understand is that this is approximately January 7th of 2001. The Bush administration is going to come into office 13 days later. The Supreme Court of the United States has decided that. If something was going to happen here to determine that some sort of malfeasance, fraud, whatever, might have occurred in the 2000 election, it had to be done quickly. This was my thinking. I mean, once you have an administration in place, it would be difficult at best to undo something. So if you kind of put yourself in my shoes back at that time, I'm thinking, number one, we don't have the resources to do the appropriate investigation quickly enough to get the results that might really make a difference. We had collected data. We did feel there were patterns that were showing up in the cards. We did feel that a further investigation was absolutely necessary. And again, the thing to emphasize is that not one answer had come out of the 2000 election. Nothing. We had no clue why the polls had been wrong and why all that chaos had been unleashed.
And I would add to that, I would just add to that really briefly. I think the Republican excuse of, you know, uneducated voters or unsophisticated, I don't think that cuts it. I just, maybe I have too much faith in the public, but I just don't buy that.
Well, I mean, there's no, why wasn't it true in 1996 or 1992 or 1998? Why was it true now? You know, it was happening now. And I mean, it's not an excuse of any kind. All you have to do is, you know, push a little piece of paper out. The system had worked well in the past. The polls had worked well. Everything had worked well. Something was different about this, and we needed answers in order to go forward. That's what I believed then. That's what I believe now. You can't just have an event like this happen. Everybody screams at everybody, and in the end, absolutely nothing is learned. So I was connected to somebody who worked with 60 Minutes, CBS 60 Minutes, which had, by the way, been one of the networks that had sort of caved in after Fox went for George Bush in the middle of the night on November 8th, 2000, and sort of jumped up and said, oh yeah, he looks like he's the next president. They sort of fell in line behind that. So I thought, well, if there's anybody out there who might, you know, want to learn more about this and might in some sense be able to redeem themselves for the whole media because it had been such a mess, maybe it would be the Grand Tiffany Network, CBS, you know, with the home of Walter Cronkite and Edward R. Murrow and all of that. So I called up somebody I know, and that person contacted Mike Wallace, the 60 Minutes star, and they set in motion very, very quickly a process by which they could go to Florida, get their hands on more cards, and do the testing that needed to be done. And this seemed like a very, very good development. They had the resources, you know, the clout, the money. Testing these things in an appropriate way was a very expensive proposition that I couldn't afford, my friend couldn't afford. So I made the best decision I knew how to make at that time, and it involved sort of handing the story over to them. And I was told in no uncertain terms that if I try to do anything on my own going forward, I would be, you know, banished forever from their bailiwick. So I didn't pay any attention to that, being a sort of independent kind of cuss. And I decided that what needed to be done was that I needed to go to Texas, where these cards were made, and I needed to get on the factory floor and look at the process and see if I could learn something from that might help me understand more about what had happened. I didn't tell CBS about this. I just went ahead and did it. And so I went down there in late January of 2001, and I talked my way into the plant, and I got on the floor, and I was shown around by a very testy plant manager.
Hank Foster, correct?
Who's named Hank Foster, and he seemed very uncomfortable with my presence in the place, but he did agree, to his credit, to meet with me and to take me around. And we were looking at how these cards are made. I won't go into much detail, but there's a stamping wheel that they go through a conveyor belt, and there's a stamping wheel that comes down and stamps out. Again, I believe it was 228 perforations on the Broward County card. And, don't hold me to that, but it's a complicated industrial process. And I was asking him a lot of questions about the last election, and he was getting more and more annoyed with me. And at one point, he blurted out, you know, we live in a 1/5,000th inch world. And I stopped him and I said, well, what does that mean? He said, if the blades that are making those perforations on those cards are altered by 1/5,000th of an inch, effectively, this is what he said, it can affect the performance of the card. And I'm like, well, whoa, you're telling me that fine of a calibration on that instrument, whether it's the knife, the blade gets dulled, the blade gets, you know, whatever. You're talking about that's the thin veneer that's protecting us from the voting system going awry? And he said, yeah. And he said, you know, we have specs on all the cards that we sent out and all of this and all of that. And I said, well, I'd like to see the specs on the cards that went out to Florida for the 2000 presidential election. Miami, Dade County had ordered 1.5 million cards from this plant. I don't recall exactly how many were in Broward County, but it was a sizable number. And so they were the primary supply for the places that ended up being in the crosshairs of all the controversy. And I said, you know, I'd like to look at those files and see what happened here. And he sort of said, it's time for you to leave. And he sort of politely led me to the door and kicked me out. So I learned a number of things by being there, but the most disturbing part of it was, you know, just seeing the absolute fragility of the system and the possibility that things could go wrong. And what really needed to be looked in here, here you have the company that supplied the bulk of the cards to the most critical areas in this election with deep ties to the Republican Party. You know, what's really happening here? What really happened on the night of November 7th, 2000? All these questions are in play. I, again, felt compelled to hand this over to 60 Minutes, and that's where this story gets a little muddy. They did not want me involved in it. They did not want to communicate with me about what was happening. They did not want to share information of any kind. And the door was sort of slammed in my face. I was repeatedly told, we're going to run a show on this, and, you know, hopefully in February. That's when the sweeps occur on television, you know, the big numbers game. So, you know, that came and went. It didn't happen. And then, we're going to do it soon. We're going to do it, you know, quickly. And I was somewhat cast out of the picture here and left to not really know. We had gathered enough information, at the very least, that this kind of investigation needed to be carried out, and it needed to be done the right way, and we needed to get some answers about our election system before we could really go forward.
And 60 Minutes basically wanted this story for themselves. It was,
yes,
they didn't really want to give you credit for it. It was sort of a production issue, them wanting the story, so they say, oh, you have to back off. But they told you this would be the biggest fish if we could cover this story, and they sort of wanted to be able to take credit for it. That's my understanding.
That's exactly what happened, and it happened very quickly. And again, when you're in these kinds of situations, you make the best decisions you can. And I thought they could get a lot more done a lot faster and a lot, you know, at a much higher level than I could.
They have the resources.
Yes. And so there began this entire period of confusion and stalling and this, that, and the other. And time passed and something happened in the United States called 9/11. And there was nobody left in the country who wanted to criticize the Bush administration or think about the previous election. As some of you will recall, the Bush approval numbers in about August of 2001 were, you know, very tepid, in the range of 40s and 50s. And a week later, they were over 90%. And history changed at that moment and has never quite been the same. So what happened in the aftermath of the election was that ES&S saw the card problem, obviously, I think through what I was doing and maybe some other people, it came to their attention. And this had been a problem. They had, strangely enough, right after the election, put up on their website that they really had no involvement in what had occurred. I'm paraphrasing that, but that's essentially what they said. They had, in fact, sold those 1.5 million cars to Miami, so they were doing everything possible to distance themselves from this. So they rushed in to Florida and a lot of other places and said, you know what, those cards have to go. We have a lot of new electronic equipment to sell you. They sold $70 million worth of equipment in Florida. They sold a lot of other equipment around the United States, and it essentially was the turning point in making electronic voting pervasive about throughout our country. So let's just jump forward a little bit because we don't have an endless amount of time. The end result of that is that we were never allowed a true investigation. And I'm leaving out a lot of things. I went to newspapers with this story, and I went to government people with this story, and I said, this is a critical story. You have to find out what happened here, either through CBS or through this, because this could be a turning point for things. It's not easy being a self-employed investigative reporter in the 21st century, and most people just sort of blew that off. That's over. That's a dead story. Okay, so let's fast forward to November 8th, I think it was, 2004. I think that's the right date, in which John Kerry is leading in Ohio and about to become the next president of the United States. And that voting system is again tied in heavily to the Republican Party at 11:14 p.m. on voting night. The system goes down, carries ahead by several percentage points. When it comes back up, the system comes back up, carries behind. Again, there's absolutely no explanation for it except something unexplained happened. He doesn't put up the fight that Gore does. He caves in and concedes. Bush has four more years. The part that I've left out of this, of course, is that if Peter Jennings had been right on November 7th, 2000, and Al Gore had been the next president of the United States, you have to wonder about the subsequent events of American history. If the Gore administration had received intelligence throughout the summer of 2001, and in particular on August 6th, 2001, that, hostile forces were going to attack the United States, maybe they would have done something about that. I won't go into the whole thing, but it's very obvious that history over the last 20 years could have been different. As people probably know listening, I think within the last week, we've tried to end the war in Afghanistan, which has gone on now for 18 years or so. So it was a crucial moment in American history where it was crucially important to figure out what happened in our election system. And instead of that happening, the company that was primarily involved in Florida rushed in, sold the election equipment. Other companies did as well, were involved in this. So the 2004 election was highly questionable. 2008 and 12 were fairly peaceful because Obama won by such a large margin. There wasn't that much in play. And then, of course, we come to 2016. And again, the fundamental primary question around the 2016 election is, to me, not the one that has been asked at all. And that's the problem with the whole story I'm telling you. The Mueller investigation, which went nowhere after 2 years and God knows how much money, was all about, what did Donald Trump know and when did he know it and all of that. And I'll try to compress all of this because I think it's critically important. None of that, to me, address the fundamental question that was in play in 2016, which is the fundamental question that was in play in 2000. Every poll that was relevant in early November of 2016 said Hillary Clinton would win the election and would win it easily. She was so far ahead, my understanding is, she was so far ahead in Wisconsin, she didn't go there because there was no reason to go there. She spent around $2 billion, my understanding is, on that campaign. Those people use polls, and they rely on polls, and polls are, generally speaking, reliable. And so the election comes, and every single poll is wrong. That, to me, was the overriding issue in the election. And I don't think Donald Trump was involved in that particular aspect of anything. I don't believe the Russian invasion of social media had a big impact, because it would have been reflected in the polling. If Hillary's ahead by 15 points in September and 8 points in October and 1 point in early November, then you can conclude that some of that was having a huge impact. That did not happen. So we have to return to the fundamental question of what happened. And I would suggest that, again, we have gone through an election where something very significant has happened, as it did in 2000, as it did in 2004, as I believe it did in 2016. Let's think about that for a minute. That's three of the last five American presidential election, that 60%, are at best questionable, and at worst, a hell of a lot worse than that. So this is not a problem that's gone away at all. And what I'm suggesting here is that between the polling, just as in Florida, and the election results, something happened. And we need to know what that something was. I'm not a computer expert. I mean, I'm anything but that. I would never put myself forward in that way. But we have become a nation that has a fantastic ability to ask the wrong questions. Because they weren't pursued in 2000, we didn't get the answer we needed. Nor did we get the answer we needed on any broad scale in 2004, when the system had basically gone from punch cards to electronic. And I think anybody with any elemental sophistication would understand that it's a lot easier to manipulate electronic voting systems than it is punch cards. Now we jump to 2016, and you can draw your own conclusion from everything that I'm saying, but I think you have to ask very, very serious questions about the electronic systems that were used in those states, about what they were connected to and how they were influenced and all of that, because polls are simply not that wrong. So, I mean, that's the essence of my story, and rather than being able to answer every question, which I can't do, I think these are the issues that need to be examined and explored and gotten to the bottom of.
Really briefly, just two more things, and then I promise to let you go. I want to ask, first, to go back to that ES and S meeting with Hank Foster, the moment that really jolts you, I think, is the point where you were at the optomical comparator room. Without going too much into the nitty-gritty details, just a real brief summary of that.
Well, what my engineer friend and I were originally looking at was very technical, the depth of the perforations on the cards blown up 30 times. So were you actually looking at something where one Chad could be manufactured in one way to be held on more tightly, obviously making it harder for that thing to come out? Or the opposite also, where it was, the perforation was deeper and it would come out more easily for that other candidate? We reached the maximum level of our technological sophistication. I was taken into a room by Foster there where you blew these things up on a light table, and you could really truly examine them in depth. And that's what I most wanted to see, when you could study it in an appropriate way and start to learn more. And I wanted to linger in that room, and I wanted to ask some questions about it, and I wanted to talk about that 1/5,000th of an inch world, and I wanted to talk about the last election. And I started to do that, and he just grabbed my arm and got me out of there. I mean, at the very least, the guy was very nervous. And this was not true later on, but I think it was true. I think I was the only person in the world who was asking those questions, at least in that setting. And basically, I wasn't accusing him of anything. I was trying to learn more about how these things were actually made and how it was done. And I was shown the door very, very quickly. So if you could picture in some alternative universe, you know, Mike Wallace going in there and saying, you know, let's get to the bottom of this thing, you know, try to imagine the repercussions of learning more about our election system and the fragility of it. And that's what we needed to know. And instead, we plowed ahead, and, you know, a lot of the history of the last 20 years has not been pretty. I mean, if we just talk about the 19 years of fighting in Afghanistan, that's one thing. But, you know, this is important stuff. That's what I'm trying to say. Our election system is important, and you have to ask the right questions, get the right answers. And that's what I would still like to see being done.
I guess in closing, all I'll say is after the election of George W. Bush, we see the normalization of attacks on our civil liberties. We see the beginning of what has become a forever war in the Middle East. This has had ramifications, and I think it's been normalized across both parties in a lot of ways. I just want to ask you in this closing note here, do you think the media didn't want to cover this story because of fears that questioning election integrity would cause maybe a panic or a loss of faith in our democratic processes?
I think that's a really, really good question. When you do this kind of work, people say things that stay with you. It's that one or two sentences, you know, 20 years later, boom, it's right there, right in front of you. And I remember going to the editor of a major American newspaper and laying this out to them, and they listened politely, and the guy said, you know, if something like that had happened, we'd know about it. And it's just like, geez, that's like saying, you know, if Woodward and Bernstein had never existed, we'd know about Watergate. No, you wouldn't. If the Washington Post was there, no, you wouldn't. Or the Pentagon Papers, or any of the rest of it. It was just stunning. It was like, we know everything there is to know. And it's part of what you're saying. I don't think people want to consider that level of malfeasance. I think you're right. I think they want to believe in, you know, something else. But it doesn't work. It just keeps coming back, you know, from 2000 to 2004 to really, I mean, 2016 is so bizarre that, you know, nobody can explain it. My understanding, and it's limited, of software is that it can be installed and deinstalled from a distance. It can be manipulated from a great distance. Where was that in the Mueller report? Where was that about the polls being wrong? Where was any of that information about the guts of our actual election system? Not, you know, somebody having a meeting somewhere in a hotel, you know, in New York City. That's the entire, it's more the refusal to sort of go below the surface of things. That's more what I see. You know, if we can blame it on an individual, if we can pick one individual and blame it on him and hate him enough, that'll somehow solve the problem. It's not solving the problem. The problem is deeper than that. If you go into the whole history of Russia's attempts to subvert a variety of things in the United States, it's all there. We don't want to look deeply enough so far to solve the problem. And the problem affects all of us. Any group, party, whatever, has the ability to manipulate this stuff. We need to clean it up. And that's my message. It obviously hasn't been cleaned up yet. And who knows what's going to happen, you know, 8 months from now when we go to the polls again this November. I think the confidence is shaken, and I think that's part of the reluctance to go into it.
Well, Stephen Singular, I want to thank you again for talking about your book, Stolen Future, with us. I always like to end on a positive note. Do you think there's any light at the end of the tunnel, any way we can address these issues and change things? And also, if you want to give my listeners any information on how they can read your books and get a copy of Stolen Future, please do so now.
Right. Well, all of my books are available on Amazon. There are a couple of e-books that are out there. If you go to stephensingular.com, S-T-E-P-H-E-N, S-I-N-G-U-L-A-R.com. Again, I've written 25 books. About 13 of them are about high-profile crimes, some other social commentary, etc. So you can do that. The light at the end of the tunnel is always, you know, our willingness to engage with the truth and try and do something with it. And, you know, sticking your head in the sand has been the essential strategy in many ways. And it's not working. I mean, we've been in a place over the last 3 years where, you know, we didn't think this could happen. But it did happen. And knowledge is a powerful thing, and we need to know more. We're capable of that. That's the light at the end of the tunnel. We're perfectly capable of fixing this if we put our intention to it.
Thank you again, Stephen Singular. And everyone, please check out Stolen Future, a very important book out now from Who What Why Press.
Thank you.
Well, there you have it. Veteran journalist Stephen Singular's investigation into the 2000 election. You can read more about it in his ebook, Stolen Future: The Untold Story of the 2000 Election. Available now, courtesy of the media outlet Who, What, Why. Next up, moving from the past to the present, we discuss the most recent developments in the current race to the White House with Counterpunch Radio's Eric Dreitzer. Now, Eric's been on a few times before. I consider him a great voice and commentator, so I decided to have him on for a conversation about Bernie, the left, and the aftermath of Super Tuesday. Let's not waste any time. I think we should get right into the conversation. Welcome back to Parallax Views, Counterpunch Radio's Eric Dreitzer. How are you doing tonight?
Not bad, hanging in there, I think, as we all are. How are you doing?
Pretty good, pretty good. I'm trying to keep my head up.
Does your head have a mask? Does your face have a mask on it as you hold it up high? Mine does. I'm going in a mask and gloves everywhere in New York City.
Well, I'm curious, what do you think of what's currently transpired with the Super Tuesday results?
Well, I mean, I think that the Bernie-crats certainly we're in for something of a rude awakening, I suppose. The consolidation behind Biden was swift. It was, the impact was severe, and I think the Sanders camp wasn't prepared for that. Certainly, his followers weren't prepared for that. But, you know, I guess more broadly, if they were really unprepared for that, if they were thinking that somehow they were just going to storm their way to a general election against Trump and then potentially storm their way into the White House and, you know, take over the political establishment, obviously that's absurd. I think it's quite obvious that the ruling class isn't that weak, that they're not just simply going to be overrun by, you know, some upstart faction from within the Democratic Party, which ultimately that's what this is. I mean, say what you will for Bernie, and I have respect for him, and I'm obviously supporting him, but he's a Democrat. I mean, it comes from the Democratic Party. That's where he's coming from, or at least sort of the left fringes of the Democratic Party, and certainly the movement with AOC and others it's within the Democratic Party. It's within the framework of the Democratic Party. So, you know, I mean, if you think that you're simply going to just take it over through some factional kind of insurgency, I think they woke up pretty quickly on, I guess that was Super Tuesday and Somber Wednesday.
It's interesting you mentioned AOC. She just made an announcement, I guess, that she would support Biden in the general if he got the nomination. A lot of people are really upset about that. I'm kind of surprised that people are upset because I'm pretty sure Bernie Sanders himself will be doing the same thing. This is just sort of how Democrat Party politics works at this point.
Well, why would she say anything other than that? It would be absurd, I think, right? I mean, she is a Democrat after all. I mean, there is a D next to her name. She does plan on running for re-election. I mean, she's not going to openly state that she's not going to back their party's candidate against Trump, who I think everybody agrees is incredibly dangerous. So, you know, she's a Democrat. She said what a Democratic politician has to say. I mean, I'm not sure that there's much else to say about that.
You're someone who is very much on the left, and I take it you don't necessarily – I mean, have you ever considered yourself a Democrat or
– No.
So with that in mind, what do you think the left needs to do going into the general and maybe with this rude awakening happening?
Well, if you mean the left, meaning the left flank of the Democratic Party, the progressive, Democratic Socialists, DSA, and otherwise, I mean, obviously, they're married to the Bernie Sanders campaign, and it's obviously a tremendously successful political vehicle. It's made tremendous inroads. It's, really drawn a lot of people into political action of various kinds. And I think that's obviously a good thing. And in some senses, you know, some people have said that it's a culmination of various movements of the past decade, you know, Occupy Wall Street and some of the union movement, like in Wisconsin, and the movement, the Me Too movement, the Black Lives Matter movement, et cetera, that sort of all of these various social movements are having their expression, their political expression in Bernie Sanders. I mean, if that's the case, then, you know, great. But the reality is that Super Tuesday shows that they are not in any position of power. They are not simply going to ride their way into power. And it's going to require all of these sort of, call it social movements that already exist to bring about the changes that he's talking about, you know? So, I mean, if we're talking about the left broadly, I mean, ultimately what it means is that the Sanders campaign has to broaden its engagement with real social movements, with grassroots organizations and so forth, so that this can actually have some life beyond this 2020 election cycle, because that is the sad reality of many of these type of progressive upstart campaigns, you know, Jesse Jackson and, you know, even to some degree, Howard Dean or early Howard Dean in 2004 and some others, that, you know, these kind of campaigns peter out and ultimately amount to nothing, but perhaps the political, you know, the politician getting a pundit job or a, you know, Democratic Party job as Howard Dean did. I think that if the campaign can morph into a social movement, that would be my hope for it. If it's going to simply try to win in the primaries and then fall in line behind Biden and then peter out, I think that's a disaster for the left. And unfortunately, maybe I'm cynical or whatever, maybe I'm just not feeling good with coronavirus all everywhere. But the truth
that's
is
what
that
you were
I
referencing
don't...
with the mask at the beginning. It completely Christ, went over my head.
Was that not clear? I thought that was clear. I was saying I'm wearing a mask, a literal mask. Yeah. So anyway, maybe I'm just sort of gloomy in my outlook, but I fear that the Sanders campaign could peter out into nothing. And, you know, I worry about that. That's the task, I think, for the left.
I was going to say, it's interesting you mentioned Howard Dean. I can certainly see some parallels at this point between 2004 and this primary.
Yeah. different circumstances, different people, you know, very different. But yeah, I mean, definitely some underlying themes. The Howard Dean movement, that might be a bit overstating it, but you know, the grassroots energy behind the Howard Dean campaign, which, by the way, Joshua Frank, managing editor of Counterpunch, wrote the definitive book on the Howard Dean campaign, I think. And, he basically turned it into a vehicle for himself, and that was about it. And I'm afraid that that could very easily happen with the Sanders campaign. Not that necessarily Bernie's driving at that, but that ultimately there is no, let's call it, translation into broader left social movements.
I would add to that, I think what's been very interesting is maybe the defeatist reaction coming out of Super Tuesday, whether it's just progressive Democrats supporting Bernie-crats, or just people more broadly on the left. And I think maybe this is mainly contained to online spaces, which I think are much smaller than, you know, people doing activism in the real world. I could be wrong about that, but I'm just sort of disheartened to see people sort of throwing in the towel. I mean, this fight was never going to be easy, and it was never going to end just with Bernie. If people are just going to throw in the towel, it's ridiculous.
I don't know what throwing in the towel really means. I mean, if it means throwing a hissy fit on social media, who cares? You know what I mean? So you throw a couple, you know, this whole thing with social media, I got to tell you, I'm at this point, after all these years doing the social media stuff, like, I'm so jaded on it, to the point where I feel like I might just have to disconnect from it completely. Because, yeah, man, I mean, I don't think that griping about what you're watching on TV, on social media, counts as, you know, I don't know, political defeat. You know, I said on Super Tuesday or whatever, Wednesday, I had all kinds of negative things to say, you know, about everything. I mean, is it defeatism? Not necessarily. I don't think that Bernie Sanders is defeated at this point. I think that he's probably hobbled. The campaign has probably got a punch in the nose, but it's certainly not defeated. But, yeah, I agree with you in the sense that the online space tends to overreact in both directions, right? The Nevada caucus results, people were like, Bernie's, we're gonna win this thing. We're gonna win this thing. You know, Bernie's gonna storm his way to the White House. Like, come on, man. You really think that the ruling class is just gonna let that happen just like that? You know, so I, you know, It's predictable that we would find ourselves here. I'm a little surprised that it's happened with Joe Biden. I mean, that I would never have predicted, that the consolidation would have happened behind him. I mean, I thought Beto or something, you know. I mean, I did not think it was going to go this way.
I guess what I meant by defeatism is I see people saying, oh, it's pointless to organize because Bernie's not going to win now. And to me, it's just like, that's such a slap in the face to people organizing in the real world. You have to organize for something, and you have to keep fighting, and you have to take it to the streets. It's not enough just to comment on social media about Chris Matthews.
Right, absolutely. Though many funny memes to be had about Chris Matthews.
Oh, definitely.
But yes, I 100% agree with you. And of course, the work has to happen, and it happens in the streets. I mean, that is a truism of left politics. I mean, the real shit is happening in the streets. It always is, you know. But you know, I mean, I do think that it's appropriate to take stock of the situation and to evaluate, you know, why it is that Bernie got his clock cleaned, et cetera. And I mean, you know, there's other things that go into all of that. And I mean, we don't need to go on conspiracy theory directions or whatever, you know, but I have all kinds of ideas about the way that the entire political system operates in this country, you know, and, I think that the Bernie people are sort of in one sense have had to kind of open their eyes a little bit to just how far the ruling class and capital is going to go to stop this.
If you don't mind, I would like to go in that direction, maybe talking about, I feel like we live in an era of conspiracy theories, whether we're talking about Democrats who are calling people like me who support Bernie Russian agents, or whether we're talking about Trumpists who see the deep state everywhere, or Bernie supporters who think the entire primary is rigged. What do you make of this age of conspiracy theory? I feel like it goes against a lot of my structural thinking on things.
Well, I'm down for conspiracy theory. I always have been, and I always will be. I find it interesting and awesome, you know, and fun. But what you're hinting at, and I think it's certainly true, is that what conspiracy theories have become is they've become political poison in a lot of ways. And to some degree, and maybe not entirely, but to some degree, they have always historically been and continue to be the realm of the right wing, the far right, you know, I mean, the Protocols of the Elders of Zion and so forth, you know. Conspiracy theory also thrives in corners of the left. And I'm not a person who instinctively discounts anything that is smeared as conspiracy theory, because a lot of things are smeared as conspiracy theory that are proven to be true. We've seen CIA coups in Iran and Chile and elsewhere that for decades were called conspiracy theories, when leftists would say that these are CIA coups and plots and not democratic overthrows of these, you know, of these left-wing governments. I'm not somebody who immediately discounts things just because they're called conspiracy theory. At the same time, I have enough experience, I guess, with the darker corners of the alt media to know where conspiracy theory, you know, call it capital C, capital T conspiracy theory, is peddled, and where it's peddled by grifters for profit, and where it really is used as a political weapon. And that has had its obviously, you know, sort of most prominent and most dangerous expression in Donald Trump himself. I mean, Donald Trump, the president of the United States, is a former guest on Alex Jones. You know what I mean? Donald Trump is one of the godfathers, quote unquote, of one of the most significant and far reaching conspiracy theory movements of the last 50 years, the birther movement. You know, so conspiracy theory is now has a tremendous social currency, and it's a political weapon, and it's in many ways become the dominant mode of thinking for the most degenerate fucking strata of our society now. You know, I mean, Trumpism is in many ways a sort of daily cycle of conspiracy theorizing.
I was going to add to that. I think when we say capital C, capital T, conspiracy theory, ultimately what we're really talking about is that while conspiracies may happen, plots may happen, there's a big difference between saying that and buying into and supporting grand conspiracy
narratives. The grand conspiracy, yes, the grand conspiracy, right. You're right. That's a better way of saying it, yes. Or, you know, conspiracy theory, you know, little T, little M, you know, trademark. Yes, absolutely. The grand conspiracy theorizing, that really does have its roots in what I was talking about in the far right and all those sort of fascist and quasi-fascist movements. Yeah, good point.
In regards to Super Tuesday, and then we'll move on to Biden a little bit, what do you think Bernie's supporters and maybe the left in general, what should we take away from it? Do you think it was, you know, as some people are saying, oh, Bernie was just screwed by the establishment? Or do you think there's mistakes Bernie may have made along the way?
Well, okay, so before we do that, let's put a pin in that if we could, because I want to hold on the conspiracy theory thing for just a second. The reason I said conspiracy theory initially and was I was going to say I have my own conspiracy theories, right? So like I was saying, I'm not somebody who just discounts and discredits, all, you know, whatever, just because people call it a conspiracy theory. Listen, I'm not saying that there's necessarily evidence of any of this, because I don't know if there is. But I have always, for at least the last 16 years in my political life, maintained that this country's elections are fraudulent. And that it's not so-called vote fraud in the way that Donald Trump talks about it. It's I don't actually trust the machines, the systems, the people who tabulate, the system of reporting. I don't trust any aspect of it. So I'm not saying Bernie was screwed by machines or anything. I don't have any of that evidence. There are people who live their lives studying this stuff and have all kinds of resources that people could go look at. I don't know anything about that necessarily. What I'm saying, though, is that I found myself on Tuesday and Wednesday looking at all of these discrepancies in places like Massachusetts between exit polls and final results, and just thinking to myself, it's just like 2016. It's just like 2004 in Ohio. It's just like 2000. You know what I mean? It's like I've seen this happen over and over again. So, you know, I don't know. I feel like there are valid questions to be asked about what exactly happened in Massachusetts, what exactly happened in a few of those other states where Bernie went in, you know, head to head with Biden and neck and neck, and all of a sudden Biden wins by 15 points. You know, so anyway, that was what I was alluding to when I said my own conspiracy theories.
Can I add something to that really briefly?
Sure.
I've been thinking over things like the 2000 election with the hanging chads. I just had investigative journalist Steven Singular on to talk about that. I've been thinking about things concerning the Diebold voting machines lately, and even the Iowa caucus apocalypse. And something I've told people is that regardless of whether we believe it was malfeasance or incompetence in these situations, ultimately it points towards the fact that we kind of need to get money out of politics. I'm not saying that's going to happen anytime soon, but I think that's the direction things have to go in, regardless of whether you believe in conspiracy or incompetence.
Well, listen, I mean, from a purely international standards perspective, I think it's very well understood that the United States is one of the only advanced countries, so-called democracies, that has electronic voting machines that do not provide a written record, that do not actually provide a paper trail, that do not have, you know, hand-counted ballots, etc. You know, it's bizarre that we all just kind of live in this fantasy world, I think, where we all kind of accept that, well, you know, this is what it is. You know, like, I've kind of always been a radical type and was never into voting, and only very recently in the last few years voted for the first time. And, you know, I fill out this paper and I stick it in this machine and it's gone. And I don't know shit about anything. I don't know that my vote was calculated correctly. I don't know anything, and I have no proof of anything, right? So it comes down to a matter of faith and trust, and the erosion of trust and faith in institution country is where conspiracy theory thrives. You know, conspiracy theory really thrives where a society can no longer have any faith that its leaders, let alone its institutions, are pure and true and responsive to their needs and so forth. And I think that that's where we're at now, which points to a sort of proto-fascist sort of firmament.
Maybe we could get into that a little bit more. What do you mean by a proto-fascist firmament? I think I know where you're going, but maybe for my listeners.
I mean that the sort of the ground is being laid in sort of the way that I'm talking about, with the sort of normalizing and mainstreaming of conspiracy thinking and sort of a fascist politics, that what we're witnessing is sort of the growth of a fascist takeover of the country, wherein the political system is essentially taken over to a large degree by fascists, more or less, because that's essentially what we're witnessing now. If the Democratic Party ultimately pushes forward with this insane plot to stop Bernie Sanders, right, and they push Joe Biden onto voters, they fracture the party. Well, they're guaranteed to lose, and that means a second term of Trump and the full consolidation of not just Republican control, but really Trumpist control over all institutions, as you know, has been reported in the New York Times and elsewhere. Trump is basically carrying out loyalty purges of all branches of the government, or at least those branches of the government that are under his purview. And what you're witnessing in some senses, and I'm not the only one saying this. In fact, I was just speaking with Yale professor and author Jason Stanley, author of, probably the most important book about fascism in the last couple of years. He calls it kind of the establishment of a single party state, a far right single party state. And it's not an understatement to say that, and that what we're witnessing now with this sort of kind of normalization, if not just conspiracy thinking, but fear mongering and hate mongering, you know, real kind of mainstreaming of dog whistling and things like that. And not just Trump, of course, people, young Republican Trumpists who are entering into politics now are speaking this way and blurring the lines between the Republican Party and fascist politics. So anyway, my point is that what we're kind of witnessing now is sort of this bubbling kind of mass of far right energy, and the conspiracy theorizing really is one of the things that emanates from that.
I would definitely agree with that. I think, too, that the sort of Democratic establishment's reaction to Super Tuesday is, it's bizarre to me, because I see a lot of people doing victory laps and saying, ha ha, you Bernie supporters, your young people didn't come out to vote, ha 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 ha. And I'm thinking to myself, those people aren't going to be energized to vote in the general either. And that probably could be a problem for Democrats if Biden gets the nomination.
Right. Of course. Well, you know, I mean, so then the other theory going around that I've seen, at least, I'm certainly not taking credit for it, is that there is some understanding in at least some quarters of the Democratic Party that Joe Biden's not going to make it across the finish line, that he's simply not capable of actually doing this, and that ultimately there's going to have to be a compromise candidate, that they're going to go to this contested convention and the Democratic Party elites don't actually want Biden to come out with the nomination, but they're desperate to stop Bernie, and that they're going to come out with some candidate like Elizabeth Warren as a unity candidate, which ultimately would explain why Elizabeth Warren is not endorsing Bernie or anybody.
Well, I was going to say, too, the other thing, not to interrupt you, is that I don't know if Democrats would necessarily benefit from winning an election. I mean, Trump has been a huge fundraising boon.
Depends.
For the Democrats.
Depends. It depends on how you look at it, because I think that we have to be fair, at least to some of the people within the establishment. There are very much establishment, you know, shitheads who are terrified of Trump, who really do desperately want to get rid of him. I think that there are still people who are, you know, corporate sellout hacks who are at least still have some moral compasses, who really fear some of these things that we're taught, that you and I are talking about. So I think it's complicated. I agree with you that there are elements of the elite within the Democratic Party who very much are just that cynical and absolutely do think that way. But I also think that ultimately there is a genuine desire to get rid of Trump and, you know, to take over. But I fear that Biden isn't the one who's going to do that. You know, and I think that that's what Warren is counting on. I think that that's what people like Kamala and others who are sitting on the sidelines are waiting and watching. You know, what's their opportunity? What's their window? Is it a VP slot? Is it maybe to come in as a unity candidate? Who knows what? All kinds of possibilities are opened up now that the Sanders campaign failed to really crush the field on Super Tuesday.
With regards to Joe Biden, assuming he does get the nomination, and I know you've sort of questioned whether that will happen, but assuming he does get the nomination, what do you think that means? Because honestly, I'm not sure that a Biden versus Trump match would end up very well for Democrats. And I'm not going to get into the whole, oh, Joe Biden has dementia. I don't even think that's necessarily the case. I think that Biden, they're sort of counting on him having this, like, folksy, oh, I make mistakes like George Bush did sort of aura to him, and people may find that appealing. But I think Trump will take advantage of that in a debate.
I think that Trump Biden general election is would be an unmitigated disaster. I think that it would be a landslide for Trump. I think that he would absolutely devastate Biden for week after week after week, just day after day, absolutely trolling him on Twitter and all of the rest of it. And it would be, and Bernie would be one of his favorite, you know, things to throw at, you know, Biden, and sort of throw raw meat at the Bernie contingent on Twitter. It would be a complete chaotic mess. And I think that that's kind of why I think that some people within the establishment are really fearful of running Biden, and they were forced to consolidate behind him, but maybe are looking at potentially some other option. Or I think maybe even a more likely scenario is that they stick with Biden, but, you know, kind of with the understanding that, like, Buttigieg or somebody else is on the ticket who's really going to be the president. You know what I mean? This sort of wink, wink, nudge, nudge.
Like, almost like a Reagan-Bush thing.
Exactly. Like George Bush and Ronald Reagan is exactly what I was going to say. I could see that playing out as well.
In regards to the Bernie campaign, what type of self-reflection do you think is needed by that campaign right now? Because I think there may have been some internal mistakes made on the Bernie campaign's part. I think it's a time for self-reflection, even with things like the horrible 7-hour voting lines, which shouldn't exist. That shouldn't be an issue in these primaries, in the general. It's ridiculous.
Well, I think a couple of things. Number one, I think Bernie is weak, and I think the campaign is weak. And when I say weak, I don't mean, you know, they don't have grassroots power, et cetera. Of course they do. I mean weak in the sense that Bernie wants to run a white gloves campaign. He wants to focus on issues. He wants to, you know, talk about poverty and talk about struggles and talk about all of these things. And he doesn't want to get nasty, et cetera. But I think that, of course, ignores everything that Bernie understands about actual politics. I mean, he claims to be a follower of Debs. He claims to be, you know, an admirer of the tradition of the labor movement. So he obviously understands the importance of, you know, militant action. And so this idea that you're not going to go for the throat on all of these people, I find really bizarre. And I think that really Super Tuesday, where has there been even a single negative ad run by Bernie? I don't know of one. Has he ever talked about Joe Biden without prefacing it with "my friend Joe Biden, this guy that I like"? Fuck Joe fucking Biden. The motherfucker is a war criminal. My first memory of Joe Biden, or one of my most vivid memories of Joe Biden, is him running for president in 2004, standing on the debate stage, talking about the need to divide Iraq into three separate countries by Kurd, Sunni, and Shia in the south. Absolute outright colonialism from this piece of shit. So no, I don't give a damn about Joe Biden or about your friendship with Joe Biden. I don't give a damn about any of that. Bernie and the Bernie people shouldn't even hesitate when they talk about Bernie bros. They should say, you bet we're Bernie bros, and we're coming for you and your families, because this is absolute war in politics. I don't mean literally coming for your families. Obviously, nobody should be saying that on social media, but you know what I'm saying. Militant politics. Yes, absolutely. They pull one. Where was it that the guy activists were protesting outside of the district attorney's house and her husband pulled the gun on them? You know what I mean? That is some serious work right there. Absolutely. Take it to these people.
We just had someone unfurl a Nazi flag
at
a Bernie event, but no one's talking about that. And that guy was not a Bernie supporter, as far as I know.
No, he's a Nazi. And yeah, I posted about that and I said that should be another wake up call to Bernie people, that why was that guy not beaten to a bloody pulp? He should have been beaten to a bloody pulp. As soon as you see a Nazi, you punch a Nazi. You know what I mean? You don't hesitate. You have to smash these people everywhere you see them because they are absolute vermin and a cancer on society. So what happens is you find that the Bernie movement needs to recognize the importance of having an edge to it, and they need to embrace the narrative that they're toxic and all of that stuff. They are calling them deplorable, and they're not even leaning into it.
Well, it's interesting because my view on a lot of this has been that, you know, everyone can talk about, you know, a Bernie supporter being mean to someone on Twitter, but I don't think normal people really follow political Twitter that much. These things don't mean much to people.
Well, I'm not so sure about that because, yes, I agree with you. Most people are not on Twitter. But what happens is this then gets filtered through the corporate media, which absolutely does shape so much of what people are thinking in this country.
True.
And, you know, and Twitter drives the social media, or excuse me, the corporate media narratives now. Twitter, you know, and social media generally does. I think it is important. What I'm saying though is that what they need to do is say, yeah, absolutely. You know, we're black women, we're natives, we're Asian immigrants, we're Mexicans, we're, you know, African Americans, we're rural whites, we have student debt, all the rest of that, and we're coming for you. You know, that. And again, I mean, look, I understand not everybody's comfortable with that sort of stuff. You know, my view on things is somewhat radical, and I'm not, you know, afraid to sort of put it in radical terms. I understand that it's not comfortable for a lot of people. But what I'm saying is that you have to go for the throat. That is what Trump understands, that seemingly nobody else, including Bernie, understands, that you go for the throat. I posted on I don't know, Twitter, Facebook, somewhere, I posted the video from 2016 from the Republican debates where Donald Trump took on the entire room of full of Republican Party donors who were booing him, and he called them out and he said, I don't need your money, I don't want your money, you're dirty, you're scum, all of these people on the stage are your puppets and I'm not your puppet, and I can talk to the American people and they can trust me because I'm the only one who's not paid by you. And he said that in a way that Bernie is not capable of.
Just two more things real briefly here. The first is, you know, I understand this whole middle class manners game that a lot of people try to play when it comes to politics. I come from a fairly middle class background. So there's a lot of ideas about, oh, you have to talk a certain way, you can't be angry. But I don't know how to apply that to people who are very desperate right now. If people are getting mean, it's because they're desperate and they can't afford health care. And it sort of bothers me, this whole debate about civil discourse, because a lot of people are just up against the wall.
Yeah, absolutely. But even more importantly, to that point, it's not that people are being mean. It's that the ruling class finally has to hear something back. That's what Twitter is. Twitter is just this ongoing yip-yapping at each other, right? And so rich, famous people, celebrities or politicians or whomever, journalists, whomever, go on there, they put their opinions out there, they get their egos validated by the number of likes, the number of retweets, etc. But in the process of that, they then have to hear from regular people, which they wouldn't normally have to do.
It's not something that people like David Brooks are used to. They're not used to having to deal with people now with social media saying, well, I think you're full of shit, Mr. Brooks.
Yeah, well, and not just, right, and I think you're full of shit is very nice. I mean, you know, I mean, like, I, you know, you know, sending gifts of guillotines and so forth. You know what I'm saying? Like, that's the real deal, because that's how people feel. And when you choose to enter into the environment in which people are able to interact with you, then fucking go cry somewhere else.
I guess the last thing I wanted to get into is that there's been a lot of talk about for South Carolina specifically, black voters not going for Bernie. I think a lot of that may also be generational. I know a lot of people of color under the age of 35 are behind Bernie. A lot of people over that age are going for Biden. What do you make of this whole debate around people of color and Bernie's support?
Give me a break. What nonsense. It's a bogus debate, right? Because ultimately what they're talking about, and it's actually somewhat racist, I think. From my perspective, it's a pretty racist way of looking at things, right? They're essentially defining the quote-unquote black vote as the Southern black vote, right? As if black is some monolithic political entity throughout the country, equivalent in all regions of the country, in all contexts. It's not. Of course it's not. You know, Southern politics in Southern states and, you know, tied up with the church and other things like that and the Democratic machine and the Clinton system, et cetera, et cetera. It's very, very different than in other parts of the country, which, you know, where you might see significant support for Bernie in African-American communities. I mean, in many of these states where Bernie is doing well, where he's leading against both Biden and Trump, you see that Bernie is performing typically somewhere right around where Biden is for African-American votes. It was in the South, right? And like I said, the South is a unique sort of, I guess you could call it somewhat insular kind of political ecosystem where all of those elements, as I said, the church and, you know, the Clinton system, et cetera, where that is in place. And obviously Biden benefited from all of that. So it's a distortion. Ultimately, it's a media distortion, right? The black vote, just like the white vote, isn't a thing. Okay. There are black people who vote. There are working class blacks. There are well-to-do, affluent, bourgeois blacks, and everything in between.
I guess the last thing, and I just thought of this, was when it comes to elections, something that I think a lot of people don't talk about, because I think it's still a sacred cow in America, is that so much of our elections are about, in some way or another, pandering to the middle class, because they vote in really droves, and they have the time to vote in droves. I've even seen David Sirota and people like AOC talk about family values, the middle class. We see Biden doing that now, saying, oh, Bernie is saying that we're the establishment, but we just want to help the middle class. And I think we have a system in America where a lot of people's votes aren't counted. People from the working class, people that have to wait in 7-hour lines. I think we need a real change there. I think I'd like to see something like elections as a federal holiday. I think that would be a big game changer. I don't know how we get there, though. I'm curious to what your thoughts are on the middle class and its relationship to voting in America, though.
Well, that's a pretty big question. I don't know if I can tackle all of that right here. I think, first of all, the term middle class is somewhat...
It's very vague.
Right. And almost like a deliberate sort of distortion, right? And sort of an attempt by American policymakers and the ruling class to sort of neuter the term working class, right? To sort of eliminate the idea of workers and workerism and unions and labor, right? And instead talk about a middle class, right? Where every factory worker can own a home in the suburbs and be in the middle class, because nobody wants to be a dirty worker. Everybody wants to be middle class, right? And if you've, and I think the, you know, studies or polls have shown that something like 80% of people think they're in the middle class, which is of course absurd, right? So the middle class is this sort of socially informed construct, I think, or, you know, almost a social value rather than an actual designation of class. Because of course, what does middle class mean if you have a home and, you know, you have a, you have a mortgage and you have two cars, et cetera, yeah, someone would say you're middle class. But what if you have no assets, right? Every month you're at zero in your bank account. You're just making, you're just getting by. I mean, you're doing everything you can to support this basic kind of lifestyle that is expected of you, right? Are you really middle class? Are you middle class if you're precarious every month? Well, I don't think so. You know what I mean? So I think that the very notion of middle class in this country has changed. I think neoliberalism and sort of the stagnation of wages and all of the wealth inequality, all of that has kind of led to this situation that we have today. But to answer your question in political terms, middle class, like I said, middle class just means everybody. Right. It's such a general term that everybody sort of thinks they're part of it. Right. Rich people obviously don't think they're part of it, but rich people are used to not being spoken to in that way. They're spoken to at fundraisers. You know what I mean? The middle class, quote unquote, is spoken to on television. Right. So it's really just an appeal to everybody that has very little meaning. And that's part of the reason why, you know, and maybe that's a minor point, but it's part of the reason why I do have some respect for Bernie using the term working class, talking about his campaign being supported by the working class of this country. And he talks about workers and he makes a point of talking about workers. And he did in regard to Bloomberg and, you know, how Bloomberg's wealth was created by the workers in his company. So, you know, kudos to Bernie to use the term workers and working class, because that's the appropriate term.
The only thing I would add to that, I've always associated middle class with the way that sociologist C. Wright Mills, the author of The Power Elite, sort of defined it as white-collar jobs. But those white-collar jobs are going away anyways now, so it's almost like an outdated concept.
But what's a white-collar job? That's right. That's the question. What's a white-collar job? Is the gig economy white-collar?
I would say not.
Well, again, right. You would. I mean, these are not people who are, you know, wearing hard hats and, you know, carrying their lunch pails onto the job site. But they're not really middle class. They're not really white collar. You know, what about teachers? Are teachers white collar workers? I don't think so. I've been a teacher. Teaching is a brutally hard, physically demanding job. It's terribly taxing. Teachers are some of the hardest workers in society, like construction workers, like sanitation workers, like every other profession of social value is real work. You know what I mean? Not, you know, this bullshit that people do on Wall Street or, you know, the kind of office gigs that a lot of people, me included, do. You know what I mean? These are white collar jobs, but that doesn't necessarily mean that everybody holding a white collar job has wealth. I think that C. Wright Mills, who is one of my, you know, in the pantheon of one of my all time favorites, Power Elite is one of the most important books, formative for me at an early age, in terms of my political development. So while I agree with him in general, you know, I think that in the 21st century, considering the weaponization of debt and the sort of, propagation is not the word, but sort of ubiquity of debt among whole generations of people in society now, burdened in such a way that that wealth creation is really now sort of, or wealth accumulation, I should say, is really sort of for the select few. Most people are in a sort of bizarre kind of 21st century indentured servitude.
Well, I suppose we'll leave it at that, Eric. If there's anything you may want to say, I always like to end on a positive note, as you know. If there's anything positive you can say, I think there's some victories we've had. I'll say that for my part. You know, seeing that Amazon had to raise the minimum wage because of Bernie supporters and activists, I found that very heartening back in, I believe, June. And I still think there's a fight going on, and I still think we can make some gains.
Absolutely. 100%. I could not possibly agree more. If anything, I'm more excited now than ever. It's just that for me, the question is what's going to come next. Because if Bernie, by some miracle, becomes president, well, okay, then that's an interesting scenario that we need to talk about. But the chances are, I think, a betting person would say that he's not going to be the president. And if he's not, where is all of this going to go? I hear Bernie talk about the failure of Obama to maintain the mobilization that existed around his campaign, to carry that into his administration and to use it as an agent of positive change. And Bernie has said that he wouldn't make that mistake, that he would keep his grassroots mobilized through his first term, through his administration, to work towards his political goals. And I think that's exactly right. And if he really believes that and isn't just blowing smoke, well, then I am excited to see what happens when this campaign ends and where does all of this go, because it could really be a significant infusion to social movements, to left currents in this country, etc. And of course, we're going to watch as a lot of the energy is going to attempt to be channeled back into other elements of the progressive wing of the Democratic Party, AOC and others. You know, I'm sure an AOC 2024 or 2028 is already ready to go, you know. So I have no doubt that that is where some of the energy is going to go. But I'm very heartened to see just how engaged so many young people have become with this campaign and what they could possibly do.
Well, there's definitely a lot of momentum that Bernie has created, and we can never forget that, because we have to use that momentum rather than squander it.
Exactly right. That's exactly the point. Climate change and all of these incredibly, all-encompassing kind of issues, the growth of fascism, et cetera. I mean, these things are going to be have to be dealt with by people uniting in real movements that really demand and force change, not through some political campaign, but through actual social movements and taking the streets. And my hope is that what we're witnessing in this campaign is sort of the coalescing of some of these other movements that have come before it, and a kind of springboard into building something much broader. I mean, you know, that might be looking at things with rose-colored glasses, but man, I mean, those are the only glasses I really want to wear.
Well, hey, Eric, I want to thank you again for coming on Parallax Views and reminding us, just like the people that say punk's not dead, we're saying the left's not dead. So thank you again for coming on Parallax Views. How can my listeners read your work and listen to your radio show?
Counterpunch Radio is the podcast. You can get that on iTunes and anywhere else that podcasts are available. Counterpunch, the website, Counterpunch, the magazine. I'm a contributor, in both places. And, we depend on support from our readership. Counterpunch has been around more than 25 years now, independent left-wing publication that is truly independent and really unique in so many ways. So anyway, Counterpunch Radio and counterpunch.org.
Thanks again, Eric.
Thank you.
Well, that does it for this edition of Parallax Views. I hope you enjoyed my chat with Eric Dreitzer of Counterpunch Radio. Please check out Counterpunch at counterpunch.org. And of course, I hope you also liked my conversation with Stephen Singular, investigative journalist and author of Stolen Future: The Untold Story of the 2000 Election. Let me know what you thought about this edition of Parallax Views by dropping me a line on Twitter at @viewsparallax or by email at parallaxviewspod@protonmail.com. Also, if you can, please consider supporting me on Patreon at patreon.com/parallaxviews, where you can hear the Parallax Views current events program the week that was, as well as archived editions of Parallax Views. And with that being said, until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax Views. To Parallax Views with Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say don't do it, just to prohibit. It's nothing else. If we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So, you know, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxiety problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight with no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.